First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
The abortion pill remains legal and available for now, but access to abortion in Florida has gotten very tight. Good morning. We're live with you from Studio 2. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, your legal and medical questions about abortion rights answered with our in-studio guest. Give us a call now, 549-2937. Then later, the NFL draft and the Jaguars, plus your guide to the May runoff elections in the city, all of that and more coming up. But first this morning, the U.S. Supreme Court has maintained access to a commonly used medication to end pregnancies. Friday night, in an interim ruling, the high court paused a lower court ruling. What it means is access to mifepristone will remain unchanged, at least for now. Florida, of course, has passed a law limiting abortion to 6 weeks of pregnancy that is being appealed. Currently, there's a 15-week abortion ban in the state. So people have lots of questions about this procedure and what it means for Florida. We're going to take a look at the medical and legal implications as we welcome in studio Dr. Stacy Tanaway, board-certified OBGYN in Jacksonville. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And Nick Allard, dean of the JU College of Law. Good morning.
Thank you for having me.
What are your questions about abortion access in Florida? Give us a call at 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Let's begin with you, doctor. On Friday night, the Supreme Court preserved access to mifepristone. What does that mean for patients in Florida that are seeking this medication to end a pregnancy?
It's good news for us in Florida and across the country. Right now, over 50% of abortion care is medical abortion through the use of mifepristone. So access is very important. It's an important form of abortion care. And so right now that right is preserved, including here in Florida.
Okay. And if more than 50% of patients seek this medication, they use it, it's my understanding, to terminate a pregnancy in the early stages, and patients that have miscarried also typically use mifepristone. Is that right?
That is correct. I think it's not talked about enough and often forgotten that this is an important part of miscarriage care as well. There's a huge proportion of women, up to 1 million women annually, that have miscarriages. And in terms of medication use for miscarriage care, mifepristone is a superior method of that as well.
This medication was approved by the FDA more than 20 years ago. The Supreme Court overruled a federal judge and said it should remain available. If the Supreme Court should eventually reverse that, or another court reverses that, what does that mean for other FDA-approved medications?
I think that's a good legal question for a legal precedent, but I think it's a very dangerous precedent because after, you know, it's been approved for 23 years now, and over the past two decades, we only have more evidence of the safety of this medication, not less and not contradictory. We have more evidence to speak to the safety of this. So I think it's very dangerous to all of a sudden backtrack and try to say otherwise, which is just simply not true.
We're in this interim period now in Florida where the legislature passed a law limiting abortion to 6 weeks of pregnancy. That is before many women even realize they're pregnant. The Florida courts may or may not rule that a 15-week abortion ban doesn't violate the state's constitution's privacy clause. So things are sort of in flux right now legally. Let me ask you, though, for women, pregnant people seeking abortions in Florida, where do things stand at this time?
Things stand at this time, we still have similar access to what we've always have. We've have the local clinics in town that still are providing the care that they always have, as well as the hospitals for the miscarriage care that we always have. We have a couple of extra hoops that we have to jump through in terms of getting multiple providers to sign off on miscarriage care and that sort of thing. But right now, we still have access to at least first trimester and up to 15 weeks for abortion care in Florida and Jacksonville.
If the six-week ban is upheld in court, Florida will no longer become a state where women really from throughout the Southeast travel to seek abortions.
Correct.
What do you anticipate to happen at that point?
I think all of these laws, if they go into effect, they will disproportionately affect people of color, low-income people, and those people are already at 3 to 4 times higher risk of maternal mortality if they have to pursue and continue a pregnancy. So it will disproportionately affect that population significantly. And it will then shift the numbers for the people who are able to seek that care to travel otherwise. It's not going to significantly change the numbers. What it's going to do is it's going to shift those numbers elsewhere for the people who are privileged enough to be able to move to other places for
people
that care.
Can afford to travel.
Correct.
To obtain the procedure. What
Correct.
Are your questions about abortion access in Florida right now? It's 549-2937. Let's talk about the legal issues as we bring Nick Allard, Dean of the JU College of Law, into the chat. All right, Dean Allard, why was the judge in Texas allowed to issue such a sweeping ruling on mifepristone in the first place?
Well, it's often said that there's nothing so powerful as a federal judge, a single federal judge, and they have quite a bit of power, but those are within bounds constitutionally. And his power, what is precisely being challenged, is whether he was outside of his proper power and not regarding the Constitution or the statutes that have been in place in the precedents for many years. So we'll see. It'll be a big surprise if the court eventually upholds his order.
Tell us more about the interim ruling from the Supreme Court. And, of course, there was a strong dissent from Judge Alito. Judges Thomas and Alito dissented, but the majority of justices voted, at least for now, to preserve access to mifepristone. What's your read on that ruling?
Well, thank you. I have to say it wasn't surprising by most legal observers of both parties or all backgrounds. And thank you for the opportunity to unpack that a little bit, because the court, which is very usual in granting a stay pending appeal, that is, that the Texas judge's order doesn't go in effect while the appeals work their way through the courts, was out without any explanation. And so I'm happy to decode what that means. And then the only dissent was from Justice Alito, and it was one paragraph, and he only focused on one issue. So here goes, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
In order to grant a stay, the parties seeking the halt of the order must show, among other things, reasonable possibility of success, that they have a reasonable chance of prevailing on the merits, and that there's would be irreparable harm. And so even the court didn't say that. That's the long established, as most recently in the Supreme Court, 1922. So they've signaling, but without mentioning it, that a supermajority, 7 out of 2, 7 against 2, including all 3 of the Trump-appointed justices, have felt that there's a reasonable chance that the United States government and the other parties challenging the judge's order will prevail. Now, Justice Alito addressed his skepticism that they could show irreparable harm. It's hard for me to get my head around that case with so many thousands, hundreds of thousands, perhaps even millions of women whose lives are upended by the uncertainty and the holding. It's hard for me to get my head around it, but the fact is that a supermajority would not have been able to grant this stay. 7 of the justices must have believed that they had sufficiently showed irreparable harm. So that's the immediate meaning of that order. And it shows that there's an uphill prospect of the Texas judges and then the Fifth Circuit's appeal to withstand scrutiny, although it'll take some time and there'll be uncertainty to unpack it.
It's 549-2937 as we discuss the state of abortion access in Florida right now and in the future. Let us know your thoughts. So as you said, all of the Trump-appointed judges who were placed on the court really specifically to overturn Roe versus Wade, they voted to maintain access to mifepristone. Was that a political calculation on the part of the Supreme Court clearly the justices can't have missed the polling on this issue. The vast majority of Americans don't want to see access to this procedure further curtailed.
I don't believe it was a political decision at all. And let me say two things about that. First of all, what's at stake? Even though abortion is deeply sensitive and impactful issue and people have very strong views and it's in itself important, what's at stake goes far beyond abortion. And it's neither a conservative or liberal issue or Republican or Democrat issue, a left or right issue. What's at stake is the viability of the entire system and rules of legal procedure and process and the rule of law in our Constitution. That's really what's at stake here. And can those rules be disregarded entirely in order to get a desired outcome? The second thing is, I think that the court is very mindful and perhaps proceeding very carefully and gingerly. And, you know, I got my psychiatric degree, same place you did, which I don't have and I don't have any inside information. But I'm sure that they are very mindful that they're under scrutiny, that people are watching the court, and that it's historic, highest, traditionally it's the highest, most respected institution among the people in the United States. And that political capital has been spent by us, by, you know, the leak of the Dobbs decision, which was never solved. Questions about why the highest court in the land does not have an ethical standard, whereas every other judge, every lawyer in the country mm-hmm. has one. Every political lawmaker has an ethical standard.
And Clarence Thomas's allegations of ethics violations in particular.
And also the view that the court, right or wrong, but the view that there's a partisan agenda that drives and that it's not just calling balls and strikes as an objective judicial body. So I think that the court is mindful that, and it's going to proceed very carefully, very cautiously, given the scrutiny that it's under at this moment.
It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Susan tweets the show, "Do you think we need to expand the Supreme Court? Judge Alito appears like a religious zealot, and Clarence Thomas appears to be corrupt." That's from one listener. There have been calls on the left to expand the Supreme Court.
Practically speaking, I think that's very unlikely to happen. I have confidence in our institutional systems and the integrity of the court, and I believe that over time, as the pendulum swings, these things will be corrected. For example, I'll give you one example. I would be astonished if the court does not take steps to adopt and abide by an ethical code of conduct and professional responsibility.
I think that's long overdue.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the medical side of this discussion. If I could ask you this question, doctor, states that have enacted abortion bans or de facto bans, like what we have in Florida now, they've seen a 10% drop in applicants for obstetrics and gynecology residencies. This decline, according to published reports, it carries a potential long-term impact on the availability of doctors to care for pregnant people and deliver babies across a big part of the South and the Midwest. That's an issue, a medical issue in Florida. Are you seeing that in your practice?
I mean, it's a significant issue across the South, these so-called medical deserts. There are large proportions of areas that don't have a board-certified OBGYN for a long distance, and they have to travel a long distance. And this is just going to create and make that divide further. We are at risk in Florida if we enact these bans of doing similar things and not being able to recruit physicians to practice in our state, not being able to recruit trainees to train in our state. And that's just going to further impact all of obstetrics and gynecologic care.
How is it affecting your practice? How do you expect it to affect your practice in the future?
Personally, I hope it doesn't impact my practice. I plan to stay here and to practice as I always have. And to provide the care to my patients that they need. But in general, I think it is driving physicians out of our state because they feel like they can't practice how they want to. So patients are going to lose their own personal physicians because of these laws as well.
So from your perspective, there's a public health cost that will be paid.
Of course.
Let's go to your calls. What are your thoughts about the state of abortion access in Florida, your questions? Now, as we've been noting, the Supreme Court has maintained the availability of mifepristone, that's a commonly used abortion pill, but at the same time, the Florida legislature has banned abortion access to just 6 weeks of pregnancy. That is before many women know they're pregnant. So give us a call, 549-2937, Tom at NAS Jax. Oh, we lost Tom. Are you there? He's not in the queue yet. Nick Allard, while we get him on the line, you know, tell us a little bit more about the Fifth Circuit. They're going to hear arguments on this May 17th. The losing side would almost certainly appeal back to the Supreme Court. How is that going to play out?
Well, this will eventually come up to the back to the court for sure. There's a division. The impact is national, and they have returned the matter to the Fifth Circuit. So they'll review what they've done and make a decision on the appeal that was before them, and then it'll come back up to the court for sure. Now, what's interesting is that really one of the things that's at stake is the entire system of drug approval in the United States. And it's worth noting, and this is, I'm venturing from law to a little bit of science, but I do have a background in pharmaceutical law, is that the statutory authority for reviewing judges sits with the Federal Drug Administration. And we are known in the United States for having the safest, most effective drugs on the planet that are available after an arduous long process. So the statutory authority, and these are the requirements for the judicial review, sits squarely with the FDA. They're not outside of their statutory authority. This is what they do. They make their decisions based on substantial evidence on the record. Well, in this case, there was mountainous evidence on the record. It doesn't matter if there's some evidence to the contrary, but they are, in fact, you know, the annual award that goes out to an FDA official is named the Mary Lasker Award, and that's named after the woman that stopped and said no to thalidomide and its harmful birth effects. It was a morning sickness drug that was popular around the world with horrible side effects, and the United States did not have that. So the award that goes out is for the competence and skill, recognizing the skill. And the FDA, if anything, is usually criticized for taking too much time, giving too much due process to approval of drugs. And so this is, the question really is one unscientific judge in one district able to set a rule for the entire country in place of the scientific expertise and the long-established statutory process for reviewing drugs?
What the high court will have to weigh, certainly. 549-2937. Now we have Tom at NAS Jax. Hello, Tom. Good morning. Go ahead, Tom. Tom, are you there? All right, Tom. I don't know why we're having issues with our phones this morning, but give us a call back, Tom. We're having issues getting people in the queue. Give us a call back at 549-2937.
This case does leave people speechless.
Okay, so doctor, you know, what are the most common questions you're getting from patients right now? Because people have a lot of people aren't sure what the status is in Florida. Just an array of legal process that has to play out in Florida alone. Forget about the Supreme Court. What are the common questions you're getting from folks?
The common questions are, will I have access? Can I still obtain an abortion if I need it? What can I do to protect myself so I don't need that? Can I have a form of permanent sterilization because I am that worried?
Really?
Yes, we have had a significant increase in requests for permanent sterilization at this point.
Are you granting those requests?
For women who are making informed decisions after counseling, of course.
What's the procedure? What sort of hoops do you have to jump through to have that done?
It's a surgical procedure, so it's far more invasive, involving for people who
But I mean, psychologically, do you have to be cleared? Anything like that?
No psychological clearance. I mean, just after a nice informed conversation about risk benefits and all of that, so they can make an informed decision that is, in fact, what they want to do, and then grant that decision.
And what about women who've had to terminate pregnancies because their life or health is threatened? There would theoretically be exceptions in the new Florida law, although It's my understanding those would be difficult to determine, and that what we're already seeing in hospitals is doctors declining to perform a procedure, even if it means saving the mother's life, because they are afraid of legal repercussions.
This is correct. And we have seen this across the country. We have seen some significant effects of cases in out of Texas, where pregnant people have had to go to extraordinary lengths to end a pregnancy that is no longer viable, that is dangerous to their health. They've had to travel out of state for these procedures. And people who can't do that are just going to be in more trouble. And that is what's going to happen here in Florida. Currently, a lot of hospitals have instituted multiple physicians signing off on a case saying that this is necessary for the health of the mother. So this has been an important step and still has preserved access for pregnancy loss and care for people that have future non-viable pregnancies.
Amy emails the show, why are lawmakers continually doing these things that the voters don't want? Well, that's a political question, and neither of you are here to talk politics. But let's get back to the legal process. Nick Allard, your final thoughts about this for people that are following this closely.
Pay attention. Your participation in understanding the democracy is important. I would say to the last caller's question that that's democracy, and like I think Churchill once said, democracy is the worst of all systems until you consider the alternatives. It can be a sloppy process, but eventually we get there over time. We make progress. I have complete confidence in our beautiful cantilevered, engineered constitutional system of democracy that eventually will get there. And it's subject to the will of the people and the consent of the governed.
Well, thank you both for appearing. Dr. Stacy Tanaway, board certified OBGYN in Jacksonville, and Nick Allard, Dean of the JU College of Law. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Much more still ahead later. Our own A.G. Gankarski on what you need to know about the candidates and the races on your ballot in the upcoming runoff elections in Jacksonville. But up next.
Probably our most well-known, we did the San Marco Place high-rise residential condos downtown on the South Bank, the Deerwood Lake across from Tinseltown, which is a big mixed-use development there.
The secrets of his real estate success. Karen Mathis talks to Michael Belanke of Chase Properties. After this, we'll be right back. Welcome back. Well, he started his real estate company here on the First Coast 30 years ago and has grown it into a major concern. In today's First Coast Success, Karen Bruni Mathis of the Jax Daily Record talks with Michael Belanke, CEO of Chase Properties.
Michael Belanke started Chase Properties in 1993 after developing and selling an auto parts company, Truck Options. Chase Properties is a Jacksonville-based real estate and land development company that emphasizes urban infill projects as well as luxury residential and high-end retail. Belanke, who is president and CEO, named the company for his son, Chase, and they now work together. Mike Belanke, thanks for joining First Coast Success.
Thanks for having me, Karen.
Well, first, what brought you to Jacksonville, and how did you find your way into a radio career to start?
So my family's been in Jacksonville for almost 100 years now. And when I was younger, quite a bit younger, 1980, I had just gotten married, and I was looking to start a new career. And a friend of mine was working at WQIK radio in sales and was having a blast doing it. And so he encouraged me to take a shot. So I applied at the number one station in town at the time, which was Y103. And I was fortunate enough to get hired there by a guy named Jack O'Brien, who I think you know as well. It was a great start for me. I did very well there. And then shortly after that, about a year and a half later, a new station, Rock 105, was really starting to take off due to the Southern rock that was occurring. A lot of it from Jacksonville, Florida. You had Molly Hatchet and Lynyrd Skynyrd and 38 Special, and they were all trying to get their newest songs played, so they'd come by the radio station and hang out, and it was just a great time to be in the radio business. We had a lot of fun doing it.
Wow, so you're on a first-name basis with all those folks.
Well, I was then. They probably wouldn't remember me by now.
I bet they would. Well, how did that evolve then into Truck Options?
So I was an avid outdoorsman pretty much my whole life, and I used to love to go hunting and fishing, and I would take my vehicle, you know, off-road a little bit, and it kept getting scratched up. And so I thought there had to be a product out there that would allow people that wanted to get, you know, these four-wheel drive vehicles to be able to go out in the woods with them, but they should be able to have something to protect it. And I couldn't find anything, so I spent the next 6 years designing a product called Truck Chaps. We ended up getting a patent on it. And when I wrote the business plan, I identified a niche in the aftermarket retail industry. And so I took the product out to Las Vegas to the world's largest aftermarket show and ended up selling the patent right at that show. So from there, we took the money and we started Truck Options. I was still in radio because I was having a great time and didn't want to give that up. So I hired some people to run it, and it took off.
And how many locations did you?
So over the next several years, we opened three stores in Jacksonville, and then we started franchising. And that really began to take off. And so by 1993, radio started going through consolidation, and it was getting to be mostly bean counters in the business, and it wasn't nearly as much fun. So I decided to spend my time between doing real estate development and expanding the retail business. So that's kind of what got me out of radio and into the real estate.
And you sold Truck Options.
I did. I sold Truck Options after 16 years because real estate was doing so well. It was consuming so much of my time, and I truly loved it. It's kind of corny because in 87, I had read the book, The Art of the Deal, and when I did, it was kind of an epiphany for me. I knew at that point that that's something I wanted to do for the rest of my life. So I finally was fortunate enough to get to a point to where I could sell the stores and just totally focus on the real estate development business.
What was real estate like then?
It was crazy. I mean, it was fun, you know, all the way up until 2007. It was so dynamic. It was amazing. But we had a ton of fun, did some really outstanding projects, and we've been very fortunate.
What are some of your projects? Refresh us.
So some of probably our most well-known, we did the San Marco Place high-rise residential condos downtown on the South Bank. We did the Deerwood Lake across from Tinseltown, which is a big mixed-use development there. And then we just finished a 300-acre active adult community in St. Johns County called Parkland Preserve. But we've done everything from marinas to, you know, townhomes to you name it.
How do you choose what to do?
We're very opportunistic when it comes to that. Believe it or not, we're very risk averse. So we like to find projects that have an exit strategy that we know we can survive no matter what happens. And I think that's why we've been able to do this for 30 years successfully and have never having to give anything back, thank goodness. But we kind of follow the market and we look for the niche in the market for the highest and best use for properties, and that's what helps us select it.
Well, Mike Belanke, CEO of and founder of Chase Properties, you do have strong views on downtown, I know, and what can you share some of those?
Yeah, so in 79, I was working downtown for Cunningham Furniture Store, and I was on Broad and Forsyth. My girlfriend worked at what was then the Ivy's Department Store building, which is now the JEA Tower. And so I would walk to meet her for lunch usually most days. And when I did, I usually had to walk in the street because the sidewalks were so crowded. It was so dynamic. That's when all the retailers were downtown, May Cohen's, Furchkitz, Levy Wolf. And it was just so much fun. Unfortunately, it started to deteriorate when urban sprawl happened and a lot of the retailers and the businesses started moving out to the suburbs. And so I'm so excited to see that starting to come back again now.
What's your next plan for downtown?
We've got a concept called Creating Critical Mass in the Urban Core. It's a template that we've put together that we think is going to help get rid of a lot of the surplus properties, and it's a way to identify highest and best uses for these particular properties, whether they should be a restaurant or a office building or residential or whatever. And we really think it could help come together, bring the downtown together, particularly these surplus properties. But I have to say, Lori Boyer has done a great job. She's got these projects really teed up. We've got about $4.5 billion worth of projects potentially getting ready to get going downtown. But we've got to have a sense of urgency about it. A lot of these same projects were teed up in 2007, and then the recession hit, and you know, here we are 16 years later, and they're just now coming back online. So, you know, if we can get them financed and under construction before the next wave hits, I think we can build right through another recession if we have one. And I'm hopeful that we're going to get there this time.
What kind of surplus properties? That's interesting.
So the city owns a lot of properties that are either vacant buildings or vacant land, and they're not generating any ad valorem tax whatsoever. So there's this big sucking sound because they're still having to pay, you know, insurance on them and maintenance on them. And they're not, like I said, generating any tax. So if we can identify what the highest and best use is for each one of these and bring them into productive use, then it's a big win. The city can get them off their books. They'll start generating taxes, and they'll bring more people, more residential, more critical mass downtown.
How does affordable housing or housing fit into that?
Oh, it fits in really well. Matter of fact, we're doing a project right now with Jacksonville Housing Authority for 102 townhome units. There's a crisis in that particular segment that really needs to be addressed. And I think the state's really doing a lot for that. They just came out with a $711 million fund to help address that. And I think you're going to see a lot of focus on that right now. We got to be able to provide a place for our firefighters and teachers and police officers and so forth to live where they can afford. So that we do have a strong emphasis there.
What is your leadership style?
It just goes back to fun. I mean, you know, like I said, this is a challenging business to be in. And the best way to overcome the challenges is to love what you do. You know, there's an old saying, if you love what you do, you never work a day in your life. And we truly, truly do love what we do.
Well, Michael Belanke, President and CEO of Chase Properties, thank you for joining First Coast Success.
Thanks for having me, Karen.
Today's segment of First Coast Success is brought to you by First Horizon.
Well, there's more at stake and on your ballot than just who the next mayor of Jacksonville will be in the upcoming May 16th runoff elections. Lots of other races you, the voters, will decide, including an at-large city council race, six district races, and the property appraiser runoff. A.G. Gankarski of Jax Today is on the line with a closer look. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. So, of course, in a few weeks, people will choose the city's next mayor, but it's the down ballot races I thought we could talk a little bit about today for people that need more information or trying to figure out who they want to vote for. An at-large race, some city council district races, and the property appraiser's race. Let's, I guess, start with the at-large Group 5 race between Charles Garrison and Chris Miller. This is a race everyone in Duval can vote on. What are your thoughts about that one?
Yeah, it's an interesting race. I mean, the UNF poll has Miller up 7 points over Garrison, 45-38. Miller's a former John Rutherford aide, has a military background. And it seems like the vote is kind of breaking his way in this one. But, I mean, it's still too close to call. I mean, when you look at a seven-point lead in a citywide poll and you've got 17% of people undecided, there's still room for Garrison to move if you get stronger than expected Democratic turnout and maybe closer. But you know, this is a big deal because this is Sam Nuvey's old seat, obviously, Republican. Nuvey's a Black Republican, so this is going to be one of those seats that goes, from one of the Black members of city council, and you had seven at this point, to definitely a white guy, probably, Miller or Garrison either way. So it's going to change the racial composition of the city council also.
Right. And of course, there are those who feel that these at-large seats should be eliminated, but this is a seat that theoretically they represent everybody in town on a range of issues, not just a particular district.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that Tommy Azuri used to talk about, like the at-large people. He was, of course, at-large at the end of his career. He talked about me being like five mayors, basically. And the saying goes in city council, it's like you have six council people. I don't know if that's really true in terms of practice, but that's the way they like to frame it. But these seats, they almost always go Republican, especially lately. We could see a Republican sweep of these seats. That's one of the things that could lead to a potential GOP supermajority in the council. So, if Daniel Davis gets elected mayor, obviously it makes things easier for him. Donna Deegan gets elected, then it becomes a war of wills where you've got like a potential override for veto she might cast on anything that is too Republican, too culture war, and you might see a replay of what you saw during Alvin Brown's term, except with even a stronger Republican cohort on the city council.
You mean seeing the council dispose of ideas a Democratic mayor might propose?
Exactly. And, if she vetoes a bill, like say they pass something like the panhandling bill and Deegan were to veto it, they could override that. It takes 13 votes to override and keep the party together. And, of course, they don't all think alike. Matt Carlucci, of course, thinks that, he'll go his own way on things. But, it's not going to be a lot of independence in the Republican members of the city council. So that's something to watch after May.
Let's talk about the district races that have gone to a runoff. Six of them, districts 2, 7, 8, 9, 11, and 14. Now, with the outcome of this redistricting lawsuit, which the city council has finally decided to settle, AG, people are still trying to figure out what district they're in as they go to vote. And they may be kind of confused about which district they live in and who they need to be voting for.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully they did some of that figuring out in March in the first election. 25% or so people actually voted in that. So a lot of people probably figured out where their polling place was if they voted day of election. Obviously, the early vote and the vote by mail, those places and those mythologies stay the same. So that's the good news there. But yeah, there are a number of these races. District 2, you've got a runoff between Republicans Lindsey Brock, Mike Gay. Lindsey Brock's the establishment guy, done a lot of boards and stuff like that. Mike Gay is a contractor. He backed Al Ferrero in the March election for mayor, so he's kind of a renegade on these issues. I think Ferrero actually backs Gay here for what it's worth, but Ferrero, since he lost that March election, hasn't really been that present in the process. But that's the dynamic there. District 7, that's one of these districts that was heavily affected by redistricting. It used to be the Reggie Gaffney district, but the map's been moved. You got the urban core, Riverside, Avondale, Ortega. You got Joseph Hogan, a Republican, Jimmy Peluso, the Democrat. This seat's got a significant Democratic advantage. Both these guys got over 30% in March, but it's probably advantage Peluso. But that's another one of these seats where you're going from, a Black councilman to a white guy. So that's another one where you're going to see Black representation on the council lowered. District 8, Reggie Gaffney Jr., that's where he is now. He's going up against Tamika Gaines Hawley. That's a really bitterly contested race there. Reggie Gaffney Jr. has been more of his own man than his father was. His father's very much kind of a dino Democrat name only. Tamika Gaines Hawley, she's a candidate of Angie Nixon, Tracy Davis, the sort of Democrats who are traditionally anti-Gaffney. And it's anybody's guess where that one goes, but it's going to be close. And there's been a lot of nastiness in that race already. Mm. The chamber actually backs Hawley in this case, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, that is.
Because, yeah, the chamber is reliably Gaffney Sr. previously. District 9, that was a traditional minority access district, but Republicans may flip this one, or at least are making to try. Mike Muldoon has like $65,000 on hand. The incumbent, Sharona Clark Murray, who won special election after Garrett Dennis left the council last year, she's got about $2,000 on hand. It's a heavy Democratic district, a lot of Black Democrats, so that bodes well for Sharona Clark Murray. But, you know, former Councilman Garrett Dennis actually endorsed Muldoon in this case. And, you know, Dennis is a Democrat. Mm. So, you know, him crossing party lines, we'll see how much it actually matters in the end. Muldoon was in District 14 before redistricting, and he actually moved over. So if he flips this, this is going to be a big deal. It's going to be something that, even though Republicans aren't messaging heavily on this now, they will all take credit if he wins this. District 11, that's an interesting dynamic too. You got rural areas. He's a Republican, married to former Action News Jax anchor Lauren Inclan. She's in Miami now, against Raymond Day, the Democrat who has run before. Day is backed by defeated Republican Norman Brewer. Brewer took a lot of hits from Arias throughout the March election, where Arias' political committee more correctly. And Brewer is crossing party lines here. He's left the Republican Executive Committee, and he's backing Day. We'll see if that actually matters. But that could be interesting. District 14, that's southwestern Duval County near the Orange Park line. Rockmon Johnson, former Soil and Water Board member, versus former Republican Councilman John Draper. Neither of these guys had a lot of money. Johnson was ahead in March. Alberta Hip split the vote with Republicans with Draper. This is a real swing district, and Rockmon Johnson could actually take this one. So you've got these things in play. And it's like Democrats really need a good showing here. They need to win in 7, 9, 11, 14, and at-large 5. They're already guaranteed 8 and 10. So the best case scenario there is 7 Democratic seats against at least 12 Republican holds. So Democrats really need to run the table, and they need for Day and Johnson to actually prevail in these elections, or else it's going to be tough sledding for Democrats for another 4 years.
Sure. Go ahead.
Yeah.
No, yeah, I was just going to ask you about the property appraiser runoff before we run out of time between Republican Jason Fisher and Democrat Joyce Morgan.
Yeah, and I will be talking about this more on Twitter Space Wednesday with Chris Sand and Andrew Batazzi. That's Wednesday at 8 p.m. But, yeah, Fisher, he's up 2 points in the UNF poll, so that's, again, too close to call. Morgan, she's been on city council. She's a former newscaster. Fisher, a former state legislator, former school board member. So far, this has been a clean campaign, but it looks like, basically partisan split will decide this one. Black voters are breaking toward Morgan. Fisher's got the advantage of the white voters in the polling. We'll see how it actually shakes out. But I think as Donna Deegan goes to the mayoral race, so will Joyce Morgan and vice versa with Davis and Fisher.
Lots to consider. And folks, again, the early voting starts very soon with Election Day, May 16th. So make a plan to vote. And thank you, AG Gankarski, regular contributor to our Jax Today. Thanks.
Thanks, Melissa.
All right, a quick break. And up next, what's in store for the Jaguars at this week's NFL Draft? That's next. We'll be right back.
The Jacksonville Today newsletter delivers all the local news you need in a 5-minute read to your inbox every weekday morning. With events and ways to get involved, little bits of joy to brighten your day, plus facts about Jack's history, and more. 15,000 of your neighbors are already reading. Find out why. Sign up at jaxtoday.org/signup. That's jaxtoday.org/signup.
Join WJCT Public Media and MOSH for a screening of Goodnight Oppie, Sunday, April 30th at 2 p.m. at the WJCT Studios. The film follows Opportunity, the Mars exploration rover affectionately dubbed Oppie by her creators and scientists at NASA. Oppie was originally expected to live for only 90 days, but she ultimately explored Mars for nearly 15 years. Reservations at wjct.org/events.
Next time on The World, Russia, Belarus, and books. Increasingly, authors and publishers there are encountering censorship and outright bans.
So they don't want any free-thinking people who think critically, and that's what literature helps you do, right? Think critically.
Publishing houses in Russia and Belarus under government threat. That story and the news on The World.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
American-made tanks will now reach Ukraine sooner than expected. But as Kyiv readies for a spring offensive, President Zelensky says his troops still don't have the ammunition they need. Meanwhile, Russia faces fallout after one of its warplanes accidentally bombs one of its own cities. We have the latest from Ukraine next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, the NFL draft is set for this week, and our own Josh Torres is following it closely with an idea of what we might expect from our own Jaguars. Hey, Josh.
Hey there, Melissa.
Okay, so before we get to the draft, players have returned from the offseason, and they've started their voluntary conditioning. How's that going? How is the team looking?
Yeah, Melissa, so right now we are essentially the 2023 season is officially started. Players returned last week for the conditioning programs. So what they are in right now is phase one, where it is basically just strength and conditioning drills, where they're trying to get their bodies back ready for NFL football. And the hype in the building is quite high right now. I mean, you look at what they were able to do last year. Most people thought, okay, you know, yes, they're improved, but they're probably still going to finish in the bottom. They're still going to probably have a top 10 pick. Mm-hmm. But then what do? They shock everybody, win the division, go to the playoffs, win a playoff game, and then, you know, now look where they're at. And so the hype is very real. Coach Doug Peterson said so. He said he has felt that hype, but he also has been trying to remind everybody, hey, this isn't going to be as simple as we're just going to repeat what we did last year. You know, we need to remember everything we went through last year and take that into this year so that way we don't make the mistakes that we made last year. Remember, early in the year, we thought, okay, here we go again. You know, team doesn't look good. We're going to be...
Yeah, it was pretty discouraging.
Exactly. And then out of nowhere, they just completely turned it around. And so he wants the guys to remember all of that. And so there's a lot of hype in the building, but also a lot of caution of we still have a lot of work to do before the season starts, and we can surely show whether or not this team is for real.
Right. Okay, so going into the draft on Thursday, the Jaguars will be picking outside the top 10 for the first time since the 2018 season. They hold the 24th overall pick. What has the team been saying about their thoughts on this pick? What do you think they do with it?
Yeah, Melissa, that's really the golden question. General Manager Trent Baalke, obviously, as he needs to, is holding his cards very, very closely to his chest. You know, you don't want to tip your hand to other teams so they can exploit that, try to force you into a trade or something or other. So they've really been kind of keeping everything close. Trent and Doug Peterson have both said that they are aware of what they believe are the needs of the team. You know, experts, people like me, can sit here and say all day what we think that they need. But and when it comes down to it, they say that, hey, we know what we need. We understand you guys have a job. You guys got to try and figure out what we need, but we know what we need. And it's going to be very interesting what they do because it's like we said, this is the first time that their first pick is going to be outside of the top 10. They've obviously had the number one overall pick, and then they usually have had a second pick in the first round that's outside the top 10. But this is the first time that they will not have a pick until outside the top 10, outside the top 20. And so that's where you really get into almost this gray zone in the first round where you almost are kind of hoping that you're finding a true first round talent and not a guy who is kind of teetering on the edge of being a first round or second or third round guy. And so it is going to be very interesting. Even experts really can't agree on what they're going to do. I looked at a couple mock drafts this morning. Every single one had a different person going to the Jaguars at 24. But the consensus is they are going to stick to the defensive side of the ball. Most people seem to believe that they are going to go towards edge rusher. And it's really kind of almost a toss-up of which edge rusher do you think they're going to take. And one thing that I thought was very interesting was last week, general manager Trent Baalke, he said that the Jags are possibly looking to either trade up or possibly even trade down further into the first round or possibly trade out of the first round to get up more picks for later rounds, which could be a smart move on their part because, again, the 24th pick is a very, very almost gray area pick where you don't know exactly what you might get in this player. So it could be smart to maybe trade out of the first round, take some extra time to figure out what you want to do and be able to possibly get more, you know, diamonds in the rough, guys who aren't first round talents, but you might actually be first round talents and just people have, you know, had something where they think, oh, well, he's not as good as this guy because of this, 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 and that. So you never know. It's going to be very interesting Thursday night.
Speaking of which, how can fans join in on all of the fun?
Yes. So as per usual, the Jags will be hosting a draft party over at Daly's Place. It is free to attend, but you do just need to register for it. You can go to their website. I believe you can also, it is available on Ticketmaster. All you have to do is go there. It's free. Just register. You'll get a ticket and you can be there part of the fun. Obviously, it's a nice little party atmosphere. I know Coach Peterson will be out there. I'm sure a few players will also be out there. So head out there, have a little fun, and it's going to be a little bit of a late night. So make sure you're prepared for that because, again, the 24th pick is probably not going to be picked till around, I'd say, 11, 11:30 at night. So be prepared for a late night, but still go out there, have a little bit of fun, and we'll see what the Jags do.
And look for Josh in the crowd maybe, right?
Possibly.
Yeah, you never know. Josh Torres, thanks as always.
Thank you, Melissa.
And thanks for listening, everyone. Thanks also to our first-round pick team. They are the best. David Luckin, Heather Schatz, Isabella Da Silva, Michelle Corum, our intern Kathy Waterman answering phones today, and theme music composed and performed by Club De Belugas. Drop us a line anytime at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. I'm Melissa Ross. This is WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. Thanks for being with us. Make it a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.